morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 16th of July. This hour, we're going to be talking about water, the availability of water, the quality of water. It's a major issue for Wisconsin and also for the country. Lake Michigan water levels, because we just haven't had very much rain, are 20 inches below the long-term average for the month of July, and drought conditions in Wisconsin's southern counties are moving north due to lack of rain. This hour, we're going to have two guests with us. Joining us at the beginning of the hour is Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Chuck Kornbach, who will be talking about Waukesha County's efforts to access Lake Michigan water. I'm sure you're familiar with those on-again, off-again negotiations, and we'll talk about the reasons that Waukesha wants Lake Michigan water, and how is it determined what communities have access to this big body of fresh water. And then the new director of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Center for Water Policy will be joining us, Jenny Kale. And we'll welcome your phone calls. I have a feeling we're going to have a lot of calls on this issue this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave messages on our Facebook page as well, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Calls are coming in as we speak. Chuck Kornbach, hello.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Tell me what the reason is. Waukesha's water isn't very good, and that's why they've been seeking water from Lake Michigan. What's that story?
Well, again, it's the radium problem out there, a potential cancer-causing compound that is in the water and could be more into the water as the water table declines out there. City is under a court order with the EPA to have a replacement in effect by 2018. There could be some wiggle room, of course, depending on the next president after 2016 and EPA negotiations with the city and so on. But right now, the goal is to get something in place by 2018, mainly because of the radium problem.
Mm-hmm. And there were negotiations. Are they off now or are they on now?
Well, negotiations with the city of Milwaukee, I've been told by Dan Dukniak, the Waukesha Water Utility Manager, last Friday afternoon, nice enough to call back during some personal time. Anyway, he said that there was a brief conversation between the city of Milwaukee and the Waukesha early last week, but it didn't get very far because of this issue that's come up in the last few weeks or months. That Milwaukee's belief that some of the Lake Michigan water is bound for four other communities in Waukesha County besides the city of Waukesha, that the city of Pewaukee, the town of Waukesha, the town of Delafield, and the town of Genesee would actually also get some access to the water eventually. Milwaukee says it doesn't want to fund growth in more than the city of Waukesha. Waukesha says, well, listen, we have no real say in the matter because the DNR and regional planners have told the city of Waukesha that the water service area has to be the same as the wastewater treatment and service areas. There's once some efforts for consistency between where water goes to and where it comes back from, so to speak. And the city of Waukesha saying, listen, we have no choice. We'd have to supply these other communities if agreements can be worked out.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, I'm unclear as to who ultimately makes the decision who gets water. This is not, I mean, Lake Michigan is not just Milwaukee's or Oak Creek or Racine. Who decides who has access to it? And for anything to be expanded requires a vote on the part of, I don't know what, mayors in communities all over Lake Michigan?
Or? Well, down the road, it's the governors of the eight Great Lakes states. But I should also mention that you asked about negotiations. So the city of Milwaukee and Waukesha are not real talking very much right now, except sort of through the media, at least it appears that way. Mm-hmm. But the city of Waukesha says negotiations, good discussions continue between Waukesha and the city of Racine and the city of Oak Creek. Mm-hmm. And there's hope by Waukesha to have a memorandum of understanding, sort of a tentative agreement in place, perhaps by next month, that one of the at least one of the common councils, Racine or Oak Creek, might be asked to vote on something by early this fall, and then it would go on to this. There'd be ongoing DNR reviews, of course, in the Public Service Commission, and then eventually, as you asked most recently, the approval would vest with the governors of the 8 Great Lakes states.
Hmm. Are they going to have to pay a lot of money to get the water?
Well, the numbers continue to change. The city of Waukesha, the cheapest amount would be negotiating with the city of Milwaukee because they're so close, only about 12 miles, 15 miles apart. And the water, of course, would not only have to go west, but treated wastewater would have to, under the Great Lakes Compact, come back east towards Lake Michigan. It could be through the Underwood Creek, Menominee River, that flows sort of west to east in Milwaukee County and is real close to Waukesha County. But if that's the route, if those two communities eventually agree, right now the numbers have fluctuated somewhere between $164 million and maybe $190 million over the years that Waukesha would be it would cost Waukesha. The numbers to Oak Creek and Racine are much higher. Although negotiations may have reduced that gap somewhat, numbers in Oak Creek may be $250 million, Racine maybe $300 million, some of the most recent reports. But again, this will all come out in the wash in the next few weeks and months as if these memorandums are struck.
Mm-hmm. You've got to think that there are a lot of communities all over the country, and certainly in the Great Lake area, because we're in the midst of a drought. Water levels are down, well levels are down. Maybe radium is a problem with some of these other communities. Is there a huge flood of negotiations going on with other communities, with other places on the Great Lakes, asking for permission to get water from the Great Lakes?
Well, I think, again, there are various things we don't know, but I think right now it's the close watch of what happens with Waukesha. It seems that the Waukesha has been bound and determined and has the resources, so to speak, to make this big push, and a lot of communities are watching. Mayor Barrett of Milwaukee recently elected as chair of the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Mayors and other local officials group reports that he got a lot of questions at the most recent meeting of that binational group, saying, well, what's all this about the other Waukesha County communities, so closely watched throughout the Great Lakes Basin and maybe elsewhere as well. But right now, the focus seems to be Waukesha, but you're right, there are other communities just in counties that straddle the Great Lakes Basin that may want this water.
Yeah, I would imagine it's becoming precious.
Well, it's this drought, as you say, sort of magnifies mm-hmm. the thought. Everyone's thinking about water. Everybody's realizing what a precious commodity it is. In my continuing effort to add value to your program, Kathleen, I biked out to Western Waukesha area yesterday, and it looks pretty dry out there. And that's not just surface; it's aquifer has having issues as well, I'm sure. So it's this sort of the odd coincidence of the drought and the water negotiations going on at the same time.
You biked out to Western Waukesha?
No problem.
Would you do that today?
After 7 p.m.
Yeah, right. I took my dog, actually, to a dog pond in Waukesha yesterday. Mm-hmm. Water was on our minds as well.
Right.
All right, so this stand, just give us where does this stand today? Are you going to be following this, or is anything budging on the story this week or next week?
Well, things can break at any time, and you know, one huge 5-inch rainstorm, and we're talking other water problems, I suppose. But for now, it seems that these negotiations with Milwaukee and Racine, Milwaukee and Oak Creek, are the ones continuing now. Again, we're not sure how much this is sort of political posturing or financial negotiations. Could Milwaukee be putting up a bit of a struggle because it wants to boost the payments that it would get? How much are politics playing
right.
a role? Milwaukee Mayor Barrett has been more forceful, it seems, in his negotiations or his public pronouncements with Waukesha since the recall election is over. And perhaps some would say he's a stronger advocate for Milwaukee, has to be less viewing of the whole state's needs than he did as a, you know, than now than as opposed to when he was a gubernatorial candidate. I heard the other day that, you know, someone, not the mayor, but others, sort of observers, said, well, you know, if there was only more Democratic votes in Waukesha County, there'd be probably no problem in striking a deal. But Waukesha is a bastion of Republican conservatism. Milwaukee is largely Democratic, and so there's some political background issue as well. You know, I would say in the next few weeks, in a month or two, we'll know. You know, everybody says Waukesha has this 2018 deadline, but again, I've seen this issue sort of pushed back over the years, and it wouldn't be terribly surprising to see it pushed back again beyond 2018 if there was a substantial chance of an agreement by, you know, that needed to be struck.
Hmm. So you're not saying there is an agreement if you hand count the votes out of Waukesha?
Well, yeah, you know, politics and environment collide often, and
yes,
politics often Trump, but everyone is operating under this timeline that maybe an agreement with local folks later this summer, talks with the state and reviews by the state later this year, and maybe going to the other states March or midsummer of next year.
Well, it has to happen. They can't keep drinking that kind of water out in Waukesha, right? It's not good for you.
Well, you know, of course, we haven't talked about conservation, and could there be additional conservation measures taken in the area? Waukesha has already done a lot on conservation. I also saw a lot of brown lawns out there, mm-hmm. Not a lot of people, you know, spraying sprinklers everywhere. So, but could there be more? Could there be more by businesses, you know, perhaps we'll see more of that as well. Certainly, the compact talks about their strong need for conservation plans, and maybe there'll be more push and shove on that, too.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that as the hour progresses. Chuck, thank you very much for being with us. Chuck Kornbach, our environmental reporter, he covers everything else as well, but has a specialty in that area, looking at what's going on with the discussions, Waukesha wanting water from the Great Lakes in negotiations with Milwaukee, not at the moment, but they've been back and forth also with Racine and Oak Creek, because they are under an order by 2018 to provide water that meets federal drinking water standards for radium. If the diversion is approved by the eight states, Waukesha would stop using deep wells drawing radium-contaminated water from a sandstone aquifer. We continue our discussion of water. What about conservation? What about the drop in levels? What about the possibility of Great Lakes water being pursued by people who live where there really is no water at all? This hour, next hour of the program, next discussion is with the new director of the Center for Water Policy at the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee, and we'll welcome phone calls as well. Here is the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now in our Milwaukee studios is the new chair in water policy and the director of the Center for Water Policy at the School of Freshwater Sciences at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Jenny Kale just started her job, actually, on July 2nd, and she comes to UWM from Rutgers, where she was an associate professor in the Graduate Department of Public Policy and Administration and Department of Political Science. She does research in political economy, and her specific interests include government negotiations with foreign investors in the extractive resource sectors and conflict in transboundary river and lake systems. She has been working in Africa and Asia on resolution of water resource allocation issues, and we're delighted to have her in Milwaukee and with us on the Ideas Network. Our phone number again, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Hi, Jenny. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
We think about these issues more now because of what's going on with Waukesha, also because we're in this profound drought in this area. But these kinds of issues of the scarcity of water, of who gets the water, of beginning to realize that this is a precious resource, we're just beginning to realize how serious all of this is, I think.
Yes, I agree, and it's a very important issue. And as we experience scarcity here in our own region, I do believe that generates interest in other regions that have dealt with scarcity issues for many generations.
Yeah. Do we look at this as a precious resource? There is something, well, the rain falls, it's not falling now, but the rain falls, we have our lakes, we turn on our tap, there's water. It's something that we don't take, I think, very seriously. And you notice even in a drought, I mean, people are watering their lawns, for heaven's sake, which maybe they ought to think twice about doing.
Yes, I agree. I definitely think it brings into focus some of the issues of scarcity that people would not normally pay attention to because we're sitting on one of the greatest freshwater resources in the world here on the Great Lakes. And so it often gives the perception that there's an abundance of fresh water. And so it's only something such as this current drought, which really does bring attention to the issue that although we sit on this magnificent freshwater resource, we also will address scarcity issues.
And there is no longer an abundance of fresh water?
There is not, considering demand. And so with population growth and increased demand for food, as well as increased pollution of waters, it means that there's less fresh water available per person than there used to be.
Mm-hmm. And there have been people who even have taken up arms over this issue, aren't there? I mean, it's a very, very serious issue in parts of the world.
That's right. And as you mentioned, I focus on transboundary water issues. And so I look at conflict, particularly preventing violent conflict in contentious river systems and lake systems worldwide, particularly in Africa. There are a lot of disputes in Asia in which people will pick up arms and will mobilize on their borders of those rivers and lakes to protect their freshwater resources. We're also seeing them now more often arming themselves around water wells and other sources of fresh water because those used to be public goods. And people that for generations have had access to freshwater resources now will find that they show up to get their water and there's a fence around it and it's locked. And so people have, in that case, taken up arms to protect the water.
Goodness gracious.
And to get access to it.
Yeah. When you look at, and I know you've just arrived here, but when you look at the Great Lakes, when you look at the incredible abundance of fresh water here, the issues are just beginning with the issue with Waukesha. I know there are a lot of other places in this country, Arizona, some of the western states that look at the water here and say, hey, we could use some of that water as well. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that? Is there a way, and should there be a way for this incredible resource to be distributed elsewhere, or is that not a good idea?
Well, I think there are many ways in which our vital resources here in this region are actually already being distributed across the country. One of the areas that's often neglected is food. We export a lot of our water through food because we're a good agricultural region. And the water that we use to irrigate our crops and then those crops that we sell in other states is actually a form of exporting that water. The other way that we export it directly is through bottled water as a commercial enterprise. And there are proposals to use more of that water farther from the confines of the Great Lakes system.
Do we need to do that? And there's also a big hullabaloo about whether or not we need to be drinking all this bottled water.
That's right. That's right. It is not cleaner than your regular water. There's a lot of misperception about that. So not only are the bottles a petroleum product, which has its own complications because they're plastic water bottles, there are also concerns about privatizing water in the form of commerce or bottling a public good such as water and then selling it. That is one of the ways that we export water from the region.
Mm-hmm. Are negotiations over who gets access to big bodies of water all over the world, do they vary from place to place? The way that we handle this in the Great Lakes mm-hmm. would be different than the way it's handled on a river that has a boundary with several different African countries?
Yes, I would say the main difference is between the developing regions and the industrialized regions. So the industrialized regions tend to negotiate those resources differently, whereas in developing countries, they have a large amount of external influence in how they negotiate those waters. So some of the river systems that I look at include the Nile in Africa and the Mekong in Asia. Mm. And as opposed to only having the Nile countries or the Mekong countries negotiating those arrangements, a lot of foreign countries' governments and a lot of foreign companies are involved in those negotiations.
And who decides who's going to be at the table? The leaders of a country? Or?
That's right. Usually the leaders of the countries will decide who comes to the negotiating table. In some cases, the external actors will try to bring countries to the negotiating table that are on the river systems or the lake systems that are not inclined to negotiate. So Egypt on the Nile is a good example. Egypt does not have an incentive to renegotiate the Nile Treaty because it benefits greatly from the status quo. So it's very difficult for the other countries that are suffering terrible droughts and having food shortages as a result to renegotiate how much water they have access to if Egypt is not coming to the negotiating table.
Oh, my gosh. And think, when we're in a big world, you can think of what's going on everywhere else.
That's right.
What's the best way to negotiate? And let's look at the Great Lakes here. What's the best way to negotiate who should have access to this incredible resource?
Well, what I have found so far is that the best way to negotiate is to bring some water use efficiency technologies to the table, because there are things that each country, and in this country, each state on a river system or a lake system can do to use their existing water resources more efficiently. And what I've found is that this decreases the intensity of the disputes and the negotiations, because it opens up some options as to how the limited water that they already have a right to can be used better. And I found that that frees up countries and governments and different interests to work more effectively, to cooperate, than to escalate to conflict.
And what are you talking about, water use efficiency?
So water use efficiency, I'm talking about more crop per drop, generally, is how it's seen internationally, or getting more food per water use for the amount of water that you're using. So one technology that's been effective in the Nile region and in widespread areas of Asia are drip irrigation technologies that a lot of countries don't have widely available, but are highly efficient and very inexpensive. And so when there are ways to make that technology available to countries, they tend to be more cooperative than competitive or escalate to conflict.
And what about in countries that are advanced? What about water use efficiency here?
So in countries that are more advanced, their negotiations tend to be more litigious. And so in Europe and in the United States and Canada, these tend to be legal agreements, policy agreements. There's a lot of negotiation over those agreements. Fortunately, they don't turn as violent quickly. So we do have a little bit of a buffer in terms of our peace negotiations. But one thing that we haven't done effectively is have areas that are water-rich and agriculture-rich offer to export technology, essentially, or make better technologies available in dry regions of this country. So one thing that we can do in the Midwest, because we have some great technical experts here, we've got some great water experts here, and we have a great laboratory, if you will, in terms of the productivity of our agriculture, there are things that we can use here experimentally that we can then export to the drier areas of the country. And making those technologies readily available, I think, could be quite helpful. It's more difficult to experiment with those technologies in dry areas because you don't have a lot of water to play with, essentially. But to experiment with those here and demonstrate some success and then use those in dry regions, I think, would help break down some of the negotiations regarding whether or not we should build transcontinental pipelines for water from the Great Lakes and those kinds of things that do pop up occasionally but don't actually have a lot of merit.
Jenny, you're a water expert. If somebody were to call you because they know you're a water expert, and we know that we haven't had very much rain here and we're in a severe drought, and they asked you, Jenny, what should we do about this? I mean, we talk about water use efficiency. Are there things that we all ought to be aware of, highly aware of right now?
Yes, I think one of the things that we should be aware of is that we're using drinking quality water for all of our water uses, and that's wasteful, and it's not necessary. So I do believe that if someone were to call me, the first thing I would say would be stop using drinking quality water for all of your water uses. Including gardening, even water for your sanitation services at home, those kinds of things. There's no reason that we need to have drinking quality water in our toilets, for example. And we can certainly use clean water for gardening and for our lawns, which is one of the most water-intensive residential uses is for our lawns and gardening. And if we didn't use drinkable quality water, what we call potable water, for those uses, we would definitely increase our water use efficiency.
So how do we get other kinds of water?
So that we also have to put pressure on the city and on the state to make those kinds of waters available to us. So right now what you can do is you can contain some of the water, or you can capture some of the water that you get in runoff from your home, and you can use that for gardening or for your lawn. But one thing that's innovative that has started in other parts of the country is using what they call gray water, and the city installs systems in which you can use clean but not potable or drinking quality water.
Really?
for other uses. So you might have a purple pipe, for example, in your backyard that would have clean but not drinking quality water with which you could very safely water your lawn.
A lot of communities have this?
Some communities do. They're experimenting with it, with it in California and other places.
Let's welcome phone calls. We have a lot of, we have a lot of people who want to talk about this, so we better go to them. Our number is 800-486-8655. Jenny Kale is our guest now, director of the Center for Water Policy at the School of Freshwater Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She has just arrived in this position just in the middle of a drought of all times. It couldn't be more timely to start this kind of work. Let's start our calls with Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
They were either going to drill or going to drill a high-capacity well down at Gay's Mills, and we had one over in that. They were going to pull, Pierre was going to pull one over in Adams County a few years ago. And I'm wondering, if it was the dry conditions we've got and drought, and our water tables and everything, if you're going to see a proliferation of these high-capacity wells in the area. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Eugene. Thanks.
I believe that we will see more experiments with those kinds of wells.
Okay. Thank you very much for your call. Jack in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Yes, about 5 weeks ago, ABC Nightly News showed a map of the USA and talked about fracking as a way to extract oil. And I was wondering if your guest had any comment about fracking. And as an aside, you know, people grow too many of these lawns with just chopping the grass off, and maybe they should go with the prairie-type lawns.
All right, Jenny.
Great. Well, on your first point about fracking, my expertise is in water, and so my concern with the fracking, although there are many, is with the water use. And one thing that doesn't get a lot of attention is how intensive the water use is with fracking. It is called hydrofracking or hydrological fracking, and so it is water that is used to basically break up the stone to get access to the underground resources that we'll use for energy. So my greatest concern is that it can't be done without access to a tremendous amount of water. And that is a policy decision that has to be made about how much water will be permitted to be used by the companies that are doing the fracking. And a secondary concern regarding the water is the pollution. When the water is used for that process, it is it results in being highly contaminated. And so there are definitely some current concerns about overuse of water or not using water efficiently for that purpose, and also contamination of water as a result.
Mm. Thank you, Jack, for the call. Here's an email that's come in. Richard from Clam Lake wants to know why we are not building desalinization plants on the coasts.
That's a good question, Richard. The U.S. does have about 1,500 desalination plants, and there are thousands of them worldwide, although the specialization in desalination is in the Middle East. And that is because the Middle East is obviously energy intensive, right? They have access to energy and no access to water. Mm-hmm. So we're dealing with basically desert countries that have a lot of oil. Desalination is a highly energy intensive industry, and so it can take the salt out of ocean water. It's basically the goal of the process. And it can do that in a couple different ways. We can talk about the technology if Richard is interested. But desalination requires energy to the point where it's not cost-effective in a lot of areas of the U.S. It is cost-effective in Saudi Arabia because, as I mentioned, they have a lot of oil and no water. But the experiments here are largely new and are not using alternative energy sources. There's one in Spain that has tried to use wind energy, but it hasn't been operational for years. So certainly it is a concern about energy use.
Do you think, considering the vastness of the oceans, that human beings will have to go to that resource eventually because of the scarcity of water, and somehow we'll have to figure out a way for it to become more cost effective?
Mm-hmm. I don't believe that's necessary. I believe that there are things that we could do in human activity that would make it necessary, but it's not necessary now. And a much more cost effective and less polluting option would be to conserve the fresh water that we have. If we manage it effectively, we do have enough fresh water. The problem is it's not being managed efficiently and effectively. And so I do not believe that desalination is necessary, and I don't believe, based on the energy use, that it's cost effective.
Yeah. Let's go to Phil in Hebron, Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, ladies. I'm in the horticultural industry, and we use about 30,000 gallons a day on our operation, which sounds like a huge amount of water. Over the last 20 years, we've been using what's called a polymer wetting agent that we add to the soil. I don't know if your expert knew anything about it. I've had a PhD out here who did some of the work on it, and he said, regrettably, I've talked two horticultural companies in the nation into using it. He said, what kind of effect are you getting? I said, we're watering every 4 days when we used to water every 36 hours, and our plants look better.
What's it called? I'm sorry, I missed it.
It's a polymer, P-O-L-Y-M-E-R, wetting agent. What it basically looks like, for glorified scientific explanation, is boogers. It's a gel that's to the soil, and the plants root into the gel, and it acts as a giant sponge, holds the water, holds the fertilizer, gives it to the plant, shrinks up, you rewater, it swells back up, and off it goes again. They're using it in Central Florida to grow carrots, but I don't believe it's used very widely. They were kind of disappointed, the originators, the lack of acceptance. People see the price and they shy away, but they don't realize what the water savings would be and all that kind of good stuff.
Huh. Interesting. Are you familiar with it?
No, I'm not familiar with it, but I'll look into it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Will you call the right person on this? She'll find out all about it. Thanks for the call. Boots in Milwaukee. Hi. Hi, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, go right ahead.
I just have two comments. I'm a stage manager for the National Green Festival, and we have some speakers and exhibitors that come through with really some interesting things. I'm wondering if something is being done about it. It seems to me that hemp is an amazing product that uses a little bit of water, has lots of yield, many uses. I'm wondering if this situation is motivating at all politically to allow a transfer of our agriculture in some places to be toward hemp. And the other thing is, we had an exhibitor that had humidifiers that would pull the water out of the air and filter it right there and create filtered water from humidifying it out of the air. And I'm wondering if those systems have become more efficient, and sticking one of those humidifiers in the middle of the desert and just pulling the drinkable water out of the air sounds like a good idea. So the energy efficiency must have to be there, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Boots.
There are some experiments in the U.S., but most of them are in Mexico and transitioning what are typically illegal crops into legal crops, and hemp is one of those. And so there are a lot of experiments with fiber in particularly south central Mexico and growing hemp for fiber, and it is more water efficient. A comparable product is bamboo. Bamboo has, it's a very efficient grower and doesn't require as much water, so there are a couple good experiments in that area.
Hmm.
The other technology that was mentioned also involves a distillation process, and distillation has become more common. It's still very expensive for households to do, but there are units for $400 to $600 that you can get that will distill water through that process. But it's actually based on a very ancient traditional technology. So we can find, from thousands of years ago, people that built small pyramids with rocks to collect water as it evaporated and then condenses on the rock and then drips in. And that is some of the purest water that you could make, even with the new technologies today. And so that is a very ancient technology that's being reinvigorated in the modern world to clean water.
Jenny, what percentage of the world's population doesn't have access to drinkable water right now?
Right now, it's about 2 billion people that do not have access to clean water worldwide, and that number is expected to increase. An additional 2 billion don't have access to regular, clean, safe drinking water on a routine basis. But there are 2 billion right now that daily struggle with not having enough water to survive.
Hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email is talk@wpr.org. We're talking about water this hour of the program. Lots of issues surfacing because of the negotiations going on with Waukesha, with Milwaukee and Oak Creek and Racine concerning getting access to the Great Lakes water supply. We have a drought going on here, and so people are beginning to be a little bit more conscious of their use of water. And we wanted a world perspective as well, because as you well know, there's, as Jenny just said, there's a lot of the world that doesn't have access to water. And are we utilizing water in the best way that we can? Does it make any sense to turn your tap on and have that be the same water that you use to flush the toilet or to water your garden? Or do we need to look at more creative use of efficiency when it comes to water use? Our guest is Jenny Kale. She's the new director of the Center for Water Policy at the School of Freshwater Sciences at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. And we'll take more phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, we'll be talking about Walter Cronkite, my favorite broadcaster ever. I still miss him so much. I know many of you do as well. It's a really remarkable biography that has just been issued on the life of Walter Cronkite. So that will be tomorrow at during our 10 o'clock hour. The availability and quality of water this hour of the show. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and Jonathan in Green Bay is our next caller. Hi, Jonathan. Hello, Jonathan. Not there anymore. Mike in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering how, when you're dealing with, we obviously are engaged in a political battle right now with respect to this, but how does someone who's addressing this issue in different political climates, how do they reach a political consensus about what data to actually adopt? I mean, it seems like there are so many different factors here, both aquifer data, data from river flows, rainfall, average rainfall flows, usage, how it's going to be used in terms of whether it's agricultural or for human consumption, or I mean, what are the best ways to get the scientific consensus around the data?
That's a very good question, and it's something that the School for Freshwater Sciences grapples with on a regular basis. Part of it, what you're relying on, is the quality of the scholars, and we're very fortunate here because we have a good set of experts who do have unbiased perspectives on what it means to acquire data in a variety of ways. But you did mention the complexity of data in general, and I believe that's really part of where the strength is. The best thing to do is get a variety of information and try to put together several different models based on different information that you have and look at what are the policy options based on these different models or these different sets of information, and then try to figure out what is the most credible set of information and what would be the most credible policy option, and what do you believe would be the most expected outcome in those three different sets of models. So that's generally where I would start, and there are a lot of people who can help do that, and so please call the School of Freshwater Sciences or myself at the Center for Water Policy, and we can help you sort through it.
Tell me more about this center. We should know more about it.
It's a center that is designed to do part of what your caller is asking, which is to look at a wide variety of data and to build evidence and acquire data so that we can solve some of these very important water issues as a critical resource. And so part of what we're looking at is doing what I just mentioned, which is what kind of information is available, what kind of information is necessary to make good decisions about water. And as we identify what kind of information is necessary to make these decisions, we can go out and have experts get the data. So with that information, then, what the Center for Water Policy can do is put together a spectrum of policy options. And so we can present with certain information what are the credible policy options. Then what needs to happen is the political leadership who will make these decisions need to be informed about the information that is feeding these different options and what the expected outcome of each option is. Mm-hmm. What the community needs to do then is to make sure that there's a democratic process involved so that when your leaders are learning about water issues and making decisions between that set of policy options, that the community has some democratic input and some democratic accountability about how those decisions are being made.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Jeff in Watertown. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, Jeff. How are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is concerning an old technology versus a new technology, and that's in the laundering of flows. As far as using a wringer washer, which I'm sure a lot of people would not want to use. But as far as the water consumption, I got on a blog pertaining to these old wringer wash machines, and the water consumption was extremely less if you went to that technology. And then I went farther onto this blog, and it sounds like there's a lots of areas in the world that are still using this technology. And I was just kind of wondering if that process or thought has ever come into any of these questions.
It has, and it's an important general issue that you're bringing up, which is that we're finding a lot of ancient technologies or traditional technologies are actually more water effective and water efficient. The reason for that is because people were generally more closely tied than the average person today to their environment in terms of their production of food, their capacity for health and sanitation. And so as we're a little bit removed from that, particularly in urban areas, we're finding some turn back to those old and traditional technologies. And that technology was, of course, developed over generations of experience. So there are certainly things that we can learn from that. My best advice on that issue is don't do your wash until your dishes or your laundry are dirty and full. That's the best I can recommend for you on that. As people invest in new technologies, find water-efficient technologies. But you're correct in saying that we do actually have to look back in some cases and find what used to work and why we need it now.
Yeah. What about all of those machines that use a lot of water? Have they been, are washing machines energy efficient? Could they be more so? Is there a whole field? I'm trying to think of other things that use water, everything mm-hmm. that uses water. Mm-hmm. So many things do. Mm-hmm. Have we tested to make sure that the best use of water is on display?
We have in some cases, but not in most cases. And so what I would actually encourage people to focus on in terms of water use efficiency is just not wasting water at mm-hmm. home. But more importantly, to learn about what's going on in agricultural and industrial uses of water, because residential use is only 10% of water use in the United States.
Really?
Yes. And so we actually need to conserve water at home. But with 90% of water use being agricultural and industrial, we really do need to take a look at some of those larger processes.
Mm-hmm. Patrick in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I'm making a general statement of all these great ideas need to be utilized by thoughtful and thinking people. And when you go out of the city, you have people that have conspiracy ideas of the fluorescent light bulb and the kind of cars you drive. So if you're going to tell them that they can't water their big, lavish, chemically induced green lawns and get some kind of washer to buy, you're talking about a conspiracy bigger than, you know, than our Kenyan president. So, you know, we're gonna just have to unfortunately sit and wait for a crisis and probably a war and a civil war over water. I mean, everything you mentioned is great and I believe in, but when you have someone telling you how to do it, it becomes a conspiracy all of a sudden.
Well, I think what is important in what you're saying is that one of the difficulties with water policy is making the problem clearly urgent without having a crisis. So we do have a drought now, and we're dealing with that. However, water is an urgent problem. And so even if there's not a water crisis, if there's not a water war, if there's not violent conflict breaking out in this country over water, that doesn't mean the problem's not urgent. And so what we do need to express is that these concerns have to be addressed now, as opposed to waiting for some kind of crisis to break out.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. What about the number of people on this earth? How does that contribute to problems with water?
That's a very good question, because we're dealing with scarcity issues. A lot of scarcity issues are environmental. Including drought or overuse, diversions, those kinds of things. However, one of the biggest issues that we're facing in the future regarding water scarcity is increasing populations. So as the population increases and we need more water for drinking, more water to grow food for more people who are consuming it, and more people who need water for health and sanitation services, we're actually going to have scarcity that is related to populations. Mm-hmm. That's also an important issue for the Midwest, particularly the Great Lakes region, to address, because we have such a magnificent freshwater resource here. But as our population increases and the demands of those population increase on our water sources, we will have scarcity issues that arise even in a water-rich region.
Huh. Alice in Sheboygan. Hi, Alice.
Hi. I'm calling. This is just a perfect segue. I I'm very concerned about the sand mining in Wisconsin. My hometown is Tahoma, and there's a sand mine over there, and they're right now negotiating with the city of Tahoma to build two wells that will give them a million gallons of water a day for their sand mining. I think it's devastating for our state. It's been here a little while, but now it's increasing the sand, of course, being used for fracking. And I have a great concern I worry about our aquifers. We are just in a heaven here with water, groundwater and surface water. And I'm very concerned about the sand mining.
As you mentioned, fracking is also a form of mining. And all of those forms of mining, as you mentioned, are water intensive. And it does need to be investigated how much water will be required. How are they getting the permits for the water? How are they compensating for the water loss? And a lot of those are political decisions. And so I would encourage you to keep on that issue.
Mm. What about water loss? The figures show that Lake Michigan water levels are 20 inches below the long-term average for the month of July. Is that a cause for concern?
I think it is a cause for long-term concern. It is, you know, we're talking about scarcity issues in general today. And, you know, even an inch of water loss does have consequences. And people who live in regions that rely on Great Lakes water can articulate what those consequences are even by the inch. So when we see a 20-inch decrease, which is below 1960 levels, and in 2007, Lake Michigan hit an 80-year low, these are great areas of concern.
Hmm. What do we do about it? We have to do conservation.
Again. That's right, conservation. And keep a close eye on diversions, right? As I mentioned, there are also some water exports from the region in food and bottled water and other things that often go unnoticed that are taking water out of the Great Lakes, but also under aquifers near the Great Lakes, to the point where some of those have sucked water out of the aquifers to the point where now water is being sucked through the bottom of the Great Lakes to feed some of those aquifers.
Really?
And that also creates a whole new spectrum of problems.
Huh. Dave in Waukesha. Hi.
Hey. It's a great program you got. I should have more of these. I got a couple of real valid points, and you sound like the perfect person that's going to handle all of them. You got number one, everybody who lives out in Waukesha County, we recycle all our water. We go in front of our house, we punch a hole in the ground, it's called a well. We go over, we drink the water from the tap, flush it down the toilet into the septic tank behind the building. So we do recycle. They got in Waukesha, they've got that golf course, and I believe Lapham and Peak are both penetrating the sandstone for that precious water that's vanishing down there. And going beyond that, Waukesha does not recycle their water, and I'm really confused about that because they send 8 million gallons a day down to Mayor Nagy in New Orleans, who dumps it right out into the Gulf. You know, and with this application they got into Milwaukee, Waukesha, the city of Waukesha, just wants to be water king out here. You look at some of those applications for what they're asking for. Now, if you go to the irrigation system to protect that, irrigation does not come out of those deep wells. Irrigation comes out of shallow aquifers, which is recycled regularly. So we can look at how much is wasted. 8 million gallons a day goes down to the Mayor Nagy down there in New Orleans, and they ought to look into it. It's a simple phrase. It's called toilet to tap. And I'll stay on the line if you'd like, and I got a lot more, but go ahead.
All right, we probably won't have time for everything, but let's start with what you've given us.
Well, water recycling is important. One of the general perceptions of water recycling is that people don't want to use or especially consume recycled water. There are some uses for which people do find it acceptable, watering lawns and other uses. But I do want to make the point that all water is recycled. And so even if people don't believe that they're using recycled water, they are. And so it's just a matter of keeping on top of to what degree is it recycled and to what quality.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the call, Dave. We want to take one more very quick call. Pam in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. An earlier caller made a point that I think was obscured a little bit, and that is that there's, in fact, a lawn industry out there that ultimately promotes the use of excess water for keeping perfect lawns. So whether it's the chemical industry or lawn seeds and lawn implements, it's an entire industry that ultimately is about inefficient use of water. And what's to be done about that?
In 30 seconds, your answer, please.
I agree with what you're saying, and I think one of the ways to address that is through public perception, which you have alluded to, which is that lush green lawns are beautiful. But in the case of a drought, as we're experiencing, people should see it or view it as wasteful. And so I think if you walk by a lush green lawn in this environment, it would be better to perceive it as wasteful than as beautiful.
All right. Thank you so much. Enjoy your stay in Milwaukee.
Thank you.
Yeah. Jenny Kale, Director of the Center for Water Policy at the School of Freshwater Sciences at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. And we also thank Chuck Kornbach, our environmental reporter, also political reporter and reporter's reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio with us earlier in the show. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing this hour, and thanks to Brett as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Great conversations ahead, and we'll be with you again tomorrow starting at 9 o'clock with an interview with the author of a great biography of Walter Cronkite. This hour tomorrow. Thanks for listening.